Hello, and welcome to the Modern Dog Trainer podcast, hosted by myself, Ines McNeil, founder of themoderndogtrainer.net, where you'll find articles, downloads, courses, and coaching on the best practices for modern pet businesses. Be sure to add this podcast to your favorite listening list on Spotify or iTunes, and join our free discussion group on Facebook called Business Support by the Modern Dog Trainer. Welcome to the Modern Dog Trainer podcast. I'm super thrilled to have our guest here today. She is well known in the industry for her work on separation anxiety and kind of leads the industry with teaching lots of other trainers on how to handle it as well. So we have Melina DeMartini, and she's going to give us kind of a little bit more thorough introduction and tell us a little bit about how you got here.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I love talking about separation anxiety, and it sort of sounds funny because a lot of dog professionals are like, oh, that is the least favorite type of behavior for me. You know, that's a lot of the consensus out there. But for me, it is my passion, and I absolutely enjoy every second of working with separation anxiety. So it's great to be here.
Oh, that's awesome.
Just a little bit about what I do. I've been working with separation anxiety for 20 years now. I don't know how 20 years flew by so fast, but it did.
Yeah.
And I not only work with clients directly, which, by the way, we have been doing separation anxiety training remotely for over 10 years before it was ever a thing to do remote training. And it's one of those behaviors that really marries beautifully with remote work, because we're leaving the dog to experience an absence. So we don't want to actually be there.
Yeah.
So in addition to working with the clients, I also have been training other dog professionals to work with separation anxiety. We have a group of over 110 certified separation anxiety trainers all over the world. And people are really doing a beautiful job of working with this issue.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it's very much needed, unfortunately.
I know.
But I'm glad that we have you and lots of other trainers that are really getting a really good grasp on this issue with dogs and their owners. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, what is separation anxiety? And we'll start with the basics.
Yeah, let's start from square one. That's always a good place to start. Well, you know, I love that you asked this question, because I think most people sort of assume, well, yeah, I know what separation anxiety is. But we also have to remember that we may understand it to a certain degree as dog professionals, but your average dog guardian has maybe a little bit of a different view. So I think it's sort of imperative that we, not only ourselves, but with our clients, that we talk about the fact that this is a panic issue, okay? And one of the things that comes to mind, both for dog professionals as well as dog guardians, is this is the most irrational seeming panic issue, right? Like, I always come home. Why would my dog be stressed about me not being home? But I want to remind people that there are a lot of fears and phobias and anxieties that are irrational. I mean, think about public speaking, flying on an airplane. You're more likely to get injured in a car crash than in an airplane flight, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of illogical types of fears and phobias out there, and seemingly irrational to us. But we have to remember, it's the learner, it's the individual that is experiencing it. It is their perception, and it is very real to them.
Yeah.
So it's super important. And I think that one of the reasons that's so sort of crucial to get that across to your average dog guardian is, oftentimes we get the call, hey, my dog is barking all day, I need you to fix that. Or my dog is destroying the house, or peeing and pooping in the house, or whatever. And we can't fix that outward manifestation without fixing and addressing the underlying anxiety, right? I can't just say, oh, we're going to get your dog to stop barking, but he's going to remain anxious.
Yeah.
We have to go into that underlying anxiety to address the outward symptoms.
Yeah. And that leads me actually to my next question is, what are some of the most common symptoms that you're like, this is definitely separation anxiety when you see them?
Yeah. Well, there's what's kind of considered the trifecta of separation anxiety symptoms that we see the most often. But boy, if we go through and look at dog body language and see all of the types of indicators that dogs have, there's a lot. Mm-hmm. But the ones that we hear most commonly are vocalization. So barking, whining, howling, particularly for excessively long periods of time when left alone. Destruction. And destruction can be anything from, you know, chewing up a magazine to literally chewing holes through drywall, yeah, right? Yeah. And then also elimination, peeing or pooping in the house only when left alone. Mm-hmm. So, and the thing that I want to emphasize there is that any of those three and many of the other indicators that we see could be reasons for other issues. Mm-hmm. So a dog barking right all day or for a long period of time when left alone might very well be a bored, understimulated animal. They might be reactive to people walking up and down the street or sort of noises and things going on. A dog that isn't completely house trained might be peeing and pooping in the house. And even destruction can be tied to lack of enrichment, lack of exercise, and so forth. So it's important to get kind of nitty gritty and down and dirty and make sure that we have a correct rule out or rule in. And yeah, that's why cameras are the best friend of any separation anxiety person.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so thankful to live in a time where we can use that to our advantage with our work with animals. It's really amazing. Yeah. So let's dive into like some common misconceptions. I think that it really, like you mentioned earlier, having compassion and empathy for the animal that is going through their perceived, you know, worst case scenarios is a really important point to make, because that can be, I feel like, hard to change, you know, how another being is perceiving the world, as we know, can be challenging. So let's talk about that for a second.
So if there was sort of one thing that, and it doesn't sound like the biggest thing, but it was one thing that I wish people would know from a misconception standpoint. I mean, there's a host of things, but we'll start with one, is that people are often confused or misguided about the fact that letting the dog sleep in the bed or giving the dog treats or taking the dog on errands with them or whatever, these activities that oftentimes people consider, you know, spoiling the dog. I personally don't like that term. I want everybody to literally spoil their dog to a certain extent, right? We get dogs so that we can cuddle with them and we can love on them and all of that. But those particular behaviors from a guardian, sleeping on the bed, et cetera, are not, and we have research to stand behind this, are not correlated with the incidence of separation anxiety. Mm. And I one of the reasons that's so important is that oftentimes people call us and they feel this tremendous guilt, like I've created this terrible problem in my dog. And it's really quite rare that someone has, not only rare, it would be such a bizarre perfect storm that someone would have to formulate to come up with, how do I give a dog separation anxiety, right? Yeah. But I want people to really understand that it is not about, you know, giving affection in various ways. And that we really know that that is not a correlation with separation anxiety. And I think that's huge for people to realize.
Yeah, to realize that it's not your fault that your dog is behaving this way.
That's right.
You know, kind of on that topic, where does it stem from? I know that life changes, you know, being adopted is like one that really tops, you know, my list is a new dog being adopted in a new home and not knowing what to expect. But what are some situations that may cause separation anxiety, or where does it stem from?
So this is a really great question. And it's one that you're going to have to cut me off because I can start talking about this answer like for hours, but I'll give you the short and skinny. I'll refer actually to an interesting study that was done by Ogata in 2016, and it was a lit review. And we're very lucky. In the past four decades, there has been a tremendous amount of research done on separation anxiety, far higher than any other dog behavior issue that exists. And so we have a lot of interesting research and understanding. One of the things that study in particular mentioned was, you know, we have all this research that shows certain correlations and certain types of ways that we can mitigate things, et cetera. We, as of yet, have very little to no information about the etiology or the reasons behind why dogs get separation anxiety. Mm. Good news, however, in the last couple of years, the brainiac people in the research world have actually discovered, and I'm not a geneticist, so I'm probably going to say this word wrong, but they've actually discovered a haplotype, which is like a genetic marker for simplification purposes, that indicates that a dog might have the propensity for separation anxiety. Wow. And I want to emphasize propensity because we know about genetics, but we also know about epigenetics. Yeah. So there, that can exist as the propensity to have separation anxiety, but maybe it's not until, let's say, the client moves to a new home that the separation anxiety starts to show up. So the dog had the potential to have it all this time, but there was a precipitating event that sort of brought it to the forefront with the epigenetics in play there. One of the things that's so great and also not so great about realizing that we've got a genetic potential is it's really helpful for you and for me to say, cool, that means it's not, you know, it's not the client's fault and it's not this and it's not that. But at the end of the day, when you have that dog and that is your beloved being that has separation anxiety, your focus switches from, well, genetics or otherwise, I've got a problem on my hands. And so we want to take the focus away from the genetic side and sort of place it on the behavior side and address the behavioral issue from a training support process. So as much as I think it is absolutely fascinating that they found this sort of genetic research with separation anxiety, I don't know that it, as of yet, really helps us. I think at some point in time, the genetic research will help us potentially develop more targeted and specific pharmacology that will be, you know, better suited for separation anxiety dogs. And I think there's other things that will come about it. But at the end of the day, if you have a dog in front of you with separation anxiety, you're not so worried about the genetics. You're worried about what you can do about the problem.
Right. You're like, okay, cool. So what do we do?
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Awesome. What are some other misconceptions about it, especially from a trainer standpoint? You know, what are some of the mistakes that you see trainers making when trying to treat separation anxiety?
So from a misconception standpoint, as opposed to a mistake, I'll start with one other misconception.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that I think, gosh, if I had known this when I first started with separation anxiety 20 years ago, it would have been really helpful. And I think people are surprised by this, but and I'll give you a funny example. Years ago, I was speaking at APDT and we had a really big audience. And I presented this discussion and I said, all right, anybody that's in the audience that will work with mild appearing separation anxiety, raise your hand, right? And no, it wasn't all the people in the audience by far, but it was a fair amount of people. And then I said, okay, keep your hand up. Now, if you will work with severe appearing separation anxiety cases, keep your hand up, otherwise put it down. And it was like, whoosh, whoosh. Yeah. You know, like the audience, like, oh, there's one lady in the back that's got her hand still raised. Great. You know, I mean, it was like nobody would touch it. Here's what's so fascinating. And this is part of what we found by having so many educated and skilled trainers working with us. The outward presentation of separation anxiety can sometimes appear mild or appear moderate or appear severe. But realistically, that is not an indicator as to whether it's going to go quickly, whether it's going to be somewhat simple or somewhat complex, because we all assume, oh, the dog that's jumping out the window and self-mutilating and screaming and all this stuff, that's going to be like a hard, long case. And the dog that's just kind of pacing around and a little and whining, you know, probably that'll go quickly. And that's not necessarily the case. There's no exact relationship that we are able to find between dogs that have an outward display that seems a little more mild than those that have an outward display that seem a little bit more severe. Mm-hmm. And that is not correlated with the difficulty or the amount of time that the case takes. And I think that's really cool because a lot of people will be like, I won't take on a quote severe case, but quite frankly, that protocol works not from a cookie cutter standpoint, but that same basic protocol of systematic desensitization will work for both. And it's really up to the individual dog as to how quickly it will proceed.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I think that's really important to understand. And really interesting. I don't think I've worked with a whole bunch of separation anxiety. I'm looking back like 10 years, but yeah, it definitely was something that I personally stayed away from in general. Just because it was, I think a lot of times people look for like the quick fix, right? And so to be able, there's a big human management component to separation anxiety beyond just the dog and expectation settings and everything that is its own challenge, right? So maybe we can talk about that. Like, how do you help your trainers kind of navigate that conversation that they're going to have with their clients on whether to pursue treatment or whether to give up the dog? Like, how do you kind of help them navigate those challenging conversations?
So you nailed it when you talked about the word expectation.
Yeah.
And in my program for dog professionals, we spend a lot of time talking about like various sort of scripts to use when talking with your average, you know, separation anxiety dog guardian. Yeah. And it's a little interesting that there is a bit of self-selection when someone that has a dog that has separation anxiety decides to reach out to a professional, there's already some
made a decision.
They've already made some of the decision. They may not know what they're in for yet.
Right.
But typically if someone comes home and the house has been destroyed, they're like, you're out. You know what I mean? I mean, if they're that quick acting, they're probably not going to say, I wonder what I can do to help my dog get through this. So we do have a little bit of a self-selecting clientele. But once we start to talk to them, it is absolutely imperative that we explain to them the components of, well, first of all, this is a panic disorder. This is something that does not, you know, this is very different than teaching your dog to sit or come when called. And we have to explain the difference and why it's different and how the process will move forward. And the most common question that we get asked, even for people that we've talked to a little bit already, is, okay, well, how long is this going to take, right? Yeah. And behind that question is really, you know, how much money do I have to invest? Right. How much time do I have to put forth? Is my dog really going to get better? All of that stuff. And I think it's important that we really keep going back to sort of the same answer, maybe, you know, revised in our verbiage every time, but reminding the client that it's the dog that sets the pace, that no matter how quickly they want their dog to get better, it's really 100% up to the dog and his or her ability to start to get less fearful and less anxious about alone time. Mm-hmm. And for some people that goes relatively quickly. Okay, maybe not quick like teaching a sit, but quickly respective to others. And for some, it takes longer. And I think it's really important to get people on board with, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know how exactly long it's going to take. What we do know is that we can make progress. And as we see that progress happening, it'll give us further and further and further insight as to, you know, how much longer it may take to arrive at the end result that we are looking for.
Awesome. Awesome. What are some, kind of going back to the mistakes that you see other professionals making sometimes, what are some of those common mistakes that you see before somebody takes the course?
The biggest mistake that we see both on dog professional side as well as on the dog guardian side is moving too fast. Mm. I sort of cringe when I see, you know, well-meaning people, be they professionals or otherwise, saying, oh, you have to start slow. Like, don't leave them for more than like 5 minutes. And then like a couple days later, leave them for like 15. And I'm like, oh yeah, no, that's not slow. That is the Ferrari speed of separation anxiety, right? And so I think the biggest mistake is pushing too hard, too fast, and not waiting and reading the dog's body language to know when to move forward on the, to the next level. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the most common. I think the one that surprises people the most, because historically in our industry, it has been the most common suggestion, is sort of dual suggestion, is to rely on crates or confinement, and also to rely on integrating interactive feeding toys,
mm-hmm, yeah,
with the protocol. And I think that people really need to understand that a desensitization protocol is a process by which we're teaching the dog that alone time is not scary. And maybe the first step of that alone time is not scary is I can step out the door, count 1,000 and walk back in, right? Maybe that's the beginning. Maybe some dogs even less, but that alone time is what we're teaching them about. And so using tools, and I'm, first of all, just to side note, I'm the biggest advocate of using interactive feeding toys for like, and food in general to get the most efficient and effective outcome when you're doing operant behavior training. But it's a little different when you're working with systematic desensitization. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems that happens with feeding toys, and we see this all too often, and it's really heartbreaking, is that we have to think about what our antecedent arrangement is. I hand you food toy, then I leave for something scary. Food toy predicts scary thing.
Yeah.
And that's exactly backwards from what we might want. And so, you know, I worry when people rely very heavily on food toys for that reason and many others. And the other is, as I mentioned, crates, because, or confinement in general. It's, again, I'm a big advocate of the use of confinement for many, many management purposes. For a lot of dogs, confinement anxiety is very, very real as a comorbid issue with separation anxiety. And a lot of people feel like they need to use confinement because they are concerned about the dog peeing or pipping or mm-hmm. chewing on, you know, the door or whatever. But if we're always, always, always teaching in very small increments that alone time is safe. So if we start out with that 1 second, let's say, And the dog goes, yeah, I can handle that. We're not putting the dog in a situation that he's experiencing tremendous anxiety and fear and phobia. Mm. So we're not going to get that distraction or elimination in the home. And so it seems logical that we have to sort of like save our environment, save our, you know, home belongings, et cetera, from being destroyed, but we won't have that problem if we're not putting the dog in a stressful situation.
Right. Right. No, I think that's a really good point in that the way I see it is those enrichment toys, which are wonderful,
amazing,
kind of become a distraction from like what is actually happening. And that's you leaving and the panic that's kind of going to follow. So it's kind of like another interesting example of like how tools can maybe seem nice at first and offer like that quick fix and appear to be working when really the main issue kind of below the surface hasn't been addressed. Right. So, yeah,
that's exactly right. And, yeah. You know, it's interesting too, because talking about having things appear as though they're really working, mm-hmm. it's really common for people to say, I'm going to exit the door and count to three or whatever. And as long as my dog is quiet, I'm going to come back in and reward him. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think when I think about that, I think, oh my gosh, we need to get this word out, because a couple things. One, at what point in time does that, you know, piece of cheese or whatever you're going to give your dog become far, far too minimal for the exertion inputted, right? So the behavior of staying alone quietly and calmly for 3 seconds, oh, I got a piece of cheese. That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. The behavior of staying alone calmly and quietly for an hour, 2 hours, whatever. Yeah. I don't know if that's, I think that's that behavior is a little too expensive for that piece of cheese, right? And there's so many other reasons that that methodology initially appears to be working, but it actually crumbles as we start to move forward in our protocol. And so I really encourage people to remember that, you know, we talk about desensitization and counter conditioning as if it's like one big word, right? I mean, it's like peanut butter and jelly. They have to go together. But yeah. That's not true. I mean, you can make a perfectly good sandwich out of peanut butter alone. And desensitization is that powerful tool that you can use. There's always some counter conditioning that's happening. You know, there's Pavlov's over there and da, da, da. But the crux of it is that if we can go through gradual exposure and teach the dog that increments of alone time are safe, we don't have to sort of complicate it by trying to give rewards at a time that is actually inappropriate for the behaviors that we're working with.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's such a great way to put it. Okay. So obviously you have a wonderful proven course and program that lots of trainers have been through and have seen lots of success. I'd love to know what led you to create that and what was that creation process look like?
Such a fun and funny question. So, as I mentioned, I've been working with separation anxiety for 20 years now, and about 11 years ago, maybe a little more, I finally got to a place where I felt like, okay, I'm comfortable. Now I really feel like I get what I'm doing. I have a process. I have a methodology. Right. I know that I won't go to, you know, point C until I finished point A and, you know, all that sort of thing. But I was so busy, so, so busy. I had so many clients that I was just working 24/7, 7 days, you know, it was just, it was crazy. And I thought, what, I don't know who to refer to, because everybody that I knew was like, oh, separation anxiety, creating a food toy. And I was like, you know, and so I was having a lot of trouble maintaining my client load. And I actually talked to Veronica Bautel, is a friend of mine. And yeah. But also she and Gina are just amazing with Dog Biz, of course. Yeah. And this was years ago. And I talked to her and I said, what am I going to do? I can't keep up with all these clients. And she said, you know what? I think you should hire an apprentice. And I was like, that's not a bad idea. Mm-hmm. So a few days later, we were catching up again. And I said, so you remember how we were talking about this whole apprentice thing? I said, well, first of all, I don't know how I'm going to have time to train an apprentice. But second of all, once I do train an apprentice, they're going to be almost equally as full as I am in a matter of weeks or months. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, if you're going to take the time to train someone, maybe you should train like two apprentices. And then it was like almost like this big light bulb went off in front of both of us where we were like, maybe I should train three or more. And then we could, you know, and so I actually truly started the program for dog professionals out of sheer selfishness, yeah. Where I was like, somebody help me. Right. And I never expected that it would become something that I continued to do. I just thought I'm going to train, you know, three, maybe four people. And then I have people to refer to. But very quickly, as a matter of fact, I'll even funnier thing. I remember telling Veronica, doesn't everybody already kind of know this stuff? I mean, it's desensitization. And she said to me, I'm going to give you a challenge. I want you to teach those people. And when you finish, you come back to me and let me know if they, you know, gave you feedback like, oh, well, I already knew all that. Right. And I was like, okay. And of course she said, I'm not going to hold back. I said, I told you so is going to come flying out of my mouth when you come back and explain that. So,
yeah.
So that's how it started. And then I just thought, well, I've trained one group and maybe we could, you know, train a few more. And then it really gained some popularity and people started becoming very interested in working with separation anxiety.
Awesome. How was 2020 for you in the program?
So there was a month or so in 2020, a month or two, right when the pandemic stuff began in March, that things were pretty slow. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly it like went the exact other direction. Yeah. And we're now having, well, I won't say we are in trouble keeping up, but I mean, it's fast and furious. There's a big, big, big demand. And
yes.
I recently saw an article of all places, someone sent it to me of all places in People, people.com. I know, right? Not exactly your high education dogs magazine or whatever, but that they did some interesting polling and they said that 50% of the, and it was a large sample size, 50% of the people that they asked said that they thought that their dog definitely had separation anxiety. And this was just published late November last mm-hmm. year. Now, 50% of the US population of pet dogs would be about 38 million dogs.
Yeah.
That's a big yeah. number. It's a big number.
Yeah. Yeah. I am hearing a lot about that as well, just with the number of people that I work with. They are seeing definitely lots more separation anxiety, especially as people are able to go back to work and that sudden change and everything. It's definitely going to cause a spike and just also the fact that it can be done remotely. So it's a really great way to kind of almost pivot your business if you need to. It's a great place to focus on if you need that kind of assistance.
And I will give a big shout out to anybody that's listening. Please get the word out that we all need to be working on separation anxiety potential right now before yeah. we get to these post-pandemic times, whenever mm-hmm. that may be, because it would be just devastating to think, well, I'm going back to work now. Oh, and I just discovered my first day at work that my dog is suffering from terrible separation anxiety. Mm-hmm. Like, let's put in these weeks and months that we have and try to mitigate Absolutely. This issue from happening.
Absolutely. And educating the owners, you know, that is a potential and that there are things you can do ahead of time to prepare for yeah. that, right? Like, and kind of plant the seed in their minds as to what's possible. I think that's important. Awesome. So I like asking a couple of questions to everybody that comes on the show. So we've kind of already addressed a couple of them. So I'll just skip to the last one. And that is, if there was one thing you could change or improve in the industry, what would that be?
That's such a good question. Okay. Well, specifically from my perspective with separation anxiety, one of the things that I come across, and this is true of a lot of behaviors, but I just have this particular perspective from separation anxiety. I would love to see this somewhat large chasm that exists between dog trainers and vets and vet behaviorists. I would like to see that start to close a little bit. And, or a lot bit, because I think that the vets and vet behaviorists are paramount to helping our clients. But I think most vets and vet behaviorists particularly do not have the kind of time or, resources to devote the day-to-day training with the client. So we both need each other so much. And I would love to see way more collaboration on this side so that we can help them and they can help us. And we all collectively, therefore, help the client and help the dogs because they need that help. They really do. And I just, that is a big, big dream of mine to see there be more interaction between those that are on the veterinary side and those that are trainers or behaviorists. Yeah,
that's fascinating. Unbeknownst to you, the person I just interviewed earlier today for the podcast actually said the same thing to that answer.
Is that, that right? Yeah. Well, put it out that's in the wonderful. World then.
Yeah, yeah. That's fantastic. Awesome. Good. Well, it was a pleasure having you. Please tell us about this wonderful course that you have, and where people can get a hold of it and how to sign up and all that.
Yeah. There's actually two courses that I'll mention. The main one that we've been talking about today is the course for dog professionals, and graduating from that course means that you become a certified separation anxiety trainer, or a CSAT, as we call them. Because everyone needs an acronym. And that course runs twice a year in January and July.
Nice.
And there's multiple offerings from a time perspective, because we have students in every time zone. And so we do offer both a 9 a.m. and a 9 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Pacific time. So that somewhat covers the time zones like Australia and Singapore when we have the afternoon one, and somewhat covers the European and US and Canadian for the morning one. We do have a pretty darn long wait list. And so for anybody that is interested in learning more about the course or potentially applying, I would do so sooner rather than later, because it might be a full year out until you get enrolled, until you get to participate in the program. My website, which is melenadimartini.com, has information for trainers as well as for dog owners. And so under the for trainers section is information about the separation anxiety certification program. And obviously, I'm always available to answer people's questions as well. Now, the second program I want to mention is something that I developed several years ago. It's an online self-paced course for dog guardians that have separation anxiety dogs. And it was sort of my answer to people sometimes aren't really ready to get started. They don't know where to start. They don't know what to do. They're not sure if they want to work one-on-one with a trainer right away, or maybe even financially, they don't have the means to do that. It's a $99 online program. It's all self-paced. You have a lifetime access to it. And I answer questions, comments, posts in that program every single day. So people are not alone. And then obviously everybody kind of supports each other in there as well. It's very comprehensive. And we have seen a lot of success from our students. So it's a lot of fun. And I recommend it if you know someone that has a separation anxiety dog and they're not sure where to turn, it's a great starting point, or even starting and ending point, mm-hmm. if they want to go through it and do the work on their own.
That's awesome. What a great idea. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure having you, and I'm really, really excited to share all this information with everybody that listens.
Thank you. This was awesome. And your audience is just incredible. So I'm so, so honored to have been here.
Awesome. Thank you for listening to the Modern Dog Trainer podcast. If you'd like to learn more and participate in our wonderful community online on Facebook, please join our Business Support by the Modern Dog Trainer Facebook group, where we have loads of free trainings, freebies, downloads, and wonderful conversations. If you'd like to learn more about working with me, the Modern Dog Trainer Academy is currently open for enrollment. In this program, I help great dog trainers build sustainable and profitable six-figure businesses. If this sounds like a program that you might find interesting, head on over to Facebook and send me a private message with the phrase six-figure trainer, and let's talk about whether this program would make sense for you. And as always, you can find loads of free resources, articles, blogs, handouts, and ebooks on my website at themoderndogtrainer.net. See you in the next episode.